You're listening to the For I Will Be With You podcast. For I Will Be With You. Daily reflections on recovery from the Bible.
Welcome back to the For I Will Be With You podcast for the 46th week of the year from November 11th to November 17th, covering Deuteronomy 5:7 to Deuteronomy 10:6. So, Deuteronomy 5:7 reads, "You shall not recognize the gods of others in my presence." Now, if this sounds familiar, it's because it's part of the Ten Commandments. So, Deuteronomy repeats the Ten Commandments. So in this commandment, God is telling Israelites that they may not practice idolatry. They may not worship idols. They may not recognize the gods of others in his presence. So what does that mean? God is present everywhere, so you can't recognize an idol anywhere, basically. And when you first read this, you think, okay, no sweat. You know, I'm not worshiping any idols. You know, I don't have any statues of deities in my home. I'm not bowing down to them. So I'm off the hook, right? Well, maybe. I think today may not have actual idol worship in our lives. I mean, some of us do, but a lot of people who believe in God and monotheism do not have idols, actual idols. However, we have idolatrous passions. I think that's how I would put it. We have things in our lives that are like idols, and these include things like money, power, sex, even anger. Things that we can become fixated on that take us away from God. Things that we, even if we don't realize it, we're sort of empowering these feelings or these things to control us. So here the Bible is reminding us we're commanded not to recognize these false gods in the presence of the real God. And, you know, of course, since we're always in God's presence, we should view this commandment as being permanently in effect. Now, if that seems sort of excessive, like, you know, can't you have like a little bit of idol worship in your life? I think the takeaway is that you need to be conscious of God in your life at all times and work on achieving conscious contact with God. And that means that you're in the presence of God, because if you walk away from that conscious contact, although God is still present, you may feel a little bit less of God's presence, and you are then more open to the self-destructive, self-seeking pursuits of modern idolatry. If you walk away from conscious contact with God, then an obsession like, you know, making a lot of money so you can be rich and buy stuff that you don't need, which would be kind of like a modern version of idolatry, that can start to sound a lot more appealing. And as we know from experience, unfortunately, that kind of behavior can take you back to a state of mind where addictive behavior is also appealing, or will seem like an answer when it isn't. Deuteronomy 7:17 says, "Perhaps you will say in your heart, quote, 'These nations are more numerous than I. How will I be able to drive them out?'" This is referring to the Israelites who are on the verge of beginning their conquest of the Promised Land. They're literally right across the river from it. They can see it. And they're about to assemble into an army and go and conquer the Promised Land, the Promised Land that God has promised to them. But to conquer the Promised Land, they have to fight a war. And there are seven nations living in that land. You know, the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Jebusites, and so forth. These were sophisticated nations with armies and fortifications. So here we have this group of former slaves who'd never had any military training, who'd spent the last 40 years wandering around in the wilderness in a state of spiritual purity, getting ready to wage war against a large enemy. Now, of course, they'd already had some military successes already, fighting against the Midianites and so forth, but there's still nervousness about this. And I think that this, what this really gets at is something that we see a lot in life, and certainly in the program, which is sort of a split between the mind and the heart. The mind might say, God is with me and I'm going to win. But the heart may disagree. In fact, that's what the verse says. Perhaps you will say in your heart, these nations are more numerous than I. And what I think this has to do with is fear. It's the power of fear creeping up on us to help us, to hurt us, help us be afraid of something that we know we can do, especially if we have conscious contact with our higher power. If God has told us that we are going to conquer the promised land, if God has told us that we can be sober if we seek conscious contact with Him and work the steps, then we should not be afraid in our hearts, even if our mind tells us, you know, to be afraid, or even if our heart tells us to be afraid. If there's a split between what we think and what we feel, and what we see and what we feel in our hearts, we need to remember that God will help us conquer our inner demons if we seek Him. And knowledge of God's will for us can calm our fearful hearts. Deuteronomy 7:25 continues on this theme of idolatry. It says, "The carved images of their gods you shall burn in the fire. You shall not covet and take for yourself the silver and gold that is on them, lest you be ensnared by it, for it is an abomination of God, your God." Right, there's a lot in this verse, but the basic meaning is God is warning the Israelites when they conquer the land, they're going to find remnants of the idols that were worshipped by the previous occupants of the land. And in fact, if you go to museums today, you can still see some of these idols that were in this land, this area of the world at that time, of the Canaanite, Philistine civilizations. So Moses tells God to burn them. I guess they didn't burn all of them. That's how they can be in the museum now. But they said Moses tells them to burn them and not take them as booty or even melt them down for the precious metals. They're to be destroyed. God understands that idols have a lure, even to the Israelites, who have sworn not to worship them. Even a trace of them can be dangerous to the spirit. Even a piece of gold that gets melted down and turned into, you know, a piece of jewelry or a coin, if it comes from an idol, it poses a risk. And addiction has a similar risk. This feeling that maybe you can still touch and feel or benefit from something from your addiction, even if it's just symbolic, you know, it's risky. And this gets at the heart of addiction and its power over us. Because even after we've maybe even almost killed ourselves or destroyed our lives with addictive behavior, the addictive lifestyle keeps its appeal. And I know I've experienced this, and maybe you have too, that, you know how bad it was, right? But part of you thinks, you know, if only I could go back to the way it was. It was so fun, right? You know? I think what God is telling us in this verse is you have to just burn up those feelings. Destroy them. Because addiction twists your brain around. Deadly habits seem sexy and interesting when we look back on them. You know? Certainly, I was telling a humorous story that when I lived in California, in Los Angeles, recovery in Los Angeles, so the drunkalogs are all sound like action movies full of, you know, car chases and prison fights and exciting things going on. And it's funny, but it's really not, because it's like people were insane and they're really lucky to be alive. And so, but it's also a bad idea to kind of romanticize these addictive times in our lives. We can play a game of chicken with substances, people, and places at once posed a threat to our lives. So God is telling us to be strong, to eradicate these feelings from our lives. Deuteronomy 8:2 reads, "You shall remember the entire road on which God, your God, led you these 40 years in the wilderness, so as to afflict you, to test you, to know what is in your heart, whether you would observe his commandments or not. So the Israelites are commanded to remember the entire road on which God led them in the wilderness. And Moses, who's channeling God's voice here, Moses could be talking about recovery, don't you think? Recovery is a long road that we travel, hopefully to a better place. And God has been with us the whole time, leading us through the experience, for better or worse. And recovery is not always easy, but God is in charge. As God led the Israelites in the wilderness to afflict and test them, to know whether their hearts would observe God's commandments or not, so too does God lead us through recovery. We are surely tested in recovery. We are afflicted. God probes our hearts to know whether we will follow his path. Nothing will test us more than recovery, but it is a test worth taking and struggling to pass. God will help us find the end of the journey. Deuteronomy 8:13-8:14 reads, meaning it's referring to when, it says when you're in the land, that's the context, when you're in the land. Deuteronomy 8:13 reads, and your cattle and sheep increase, and you increase silver and gold for yourselves, and everything that you have will increase, and your heart will become haughty, and you will forget God, your God, who took you out of the land of Egypt from the house of slavery. Now, if you've been paying attention, you've noticed the last three verses have used this phrase, your God. So God is speaking personally to each individual, saying, I am your God. Okay, and here he's warning everybody not to become haughty, not to become superior feeling once they've become prosperous. God understands that complacency is spiritually dangerous, that once you get have it made, so to speak, once you become fat and rich and successful, it's totally natural and totally human to start thinking that you are responsible for your success, not God. This is a completely natural instinct, and God is warning us to keep our minds on it. You can forget, it's easy to forget God's hand in making everything happen. You know, and you can imagine, so the Israelites, maybe they've been in the land for 100 years, and they know, of course, they do all the devotion, and they know that God freed them from slavery in Egypt and miraculously delivered them to this land. But when they're sort of fat and happy with all their flocks of sheep and their crops and everything, they might think, hey, you know, I got it made and I did all this. I'm responsible for this. So there's a constant imploring of the Israelites to remember that God is the source of what they have. And if you're successful, God is rewarding you or, you know, giving you something special. But, and you have to do your part, of course. I mean, this is where it gets a little bit tricky. You have to do your part. God expects you to do your work in life to make yourself successful. But the source of the success is from God. And we face a similar challenge in recovery. For a lot of us, recovery can be a time of personal success. Certainly, it's amazing sometimes what people can accomplish when they stop killing themselves with drugs and alcohol. Like, people just reveal themselves to be talented and successful. People often do make quite a lot of money. And so we beat back the illnesses of addiction and put our lives back together. We can find ourselves with a lot of success. And this is great, of course. This is wonderful. But we should never forget where it all came from. Yes, we did the work. We have to do the work. But it is God that is behind our success. We need to resist the haughtiness that can come with success in recovery. If we cannot do this, we risk letting ego take over and falling prey to the very problems that plagued us before. Deuteronomy 9:1-9:2 reads, Hear, O Israel, today you cross the Jordan to come and drive out nations that are greater and mightier than you, cities that are greater and fortified up to the heavens, a great and lofty people, children of giants that you knew of whom you have heard. Who can stand up against the children of a giant? We sometimes forget in the sweep of history, in the sort of epic narrative of the Bible, that there actually once was a day, a specific day, when the Israelites woke up in the morning and crossed the Jordan River to begin that conquest of the Promised Land. It says here in the verse, "Hear, O Israel, today you crossed the Jordan." What do you think that day felt like? It's sort of like you see those movies of D-Day where the men were in the ships. They knew they were going to go across the English Channel and walk into German machine guns. You know, like this, there was a day when it all started. What was that day like? In Hebrew, it's Hayom, the day. Surely a momentous day, right? A day of fear and courage, a day of immense faith. We also have such days. Maybe we call it today or yesterday. Maybe it's going to be tomorrow. Each day is special in recovery. Recovery is, as we say, a day-at-a-time deal. You have to wake up and get ready to conquer your life, conquer your fears, do battle with temptations. And we have today. Yesterday is history, tomorrow's a mystery, as we say in the program. Today is what matters. And you know, on some days, we are going to feel, perhaps as the Israelites felt, they were going to do battle with nations that are greater and mightier than us, against cities that are great and fortified. You know, we're going to battle with lofty people, the children of giants, so to speak. That's maybe a good way to think of addictions. Addictions are like giants that we have to do battle with, great and lofty giants. But we can kill the giants. We can slay these giants if we stand up against them and bring God with us. God can help us be strong in this mission every day. Deuteronomy 10:6 says, "The children of Israel journeyed from Beeroth ben Jaakan to Moserah. There Aaron died, and he was buried there, and Eleazar his son ministered in his place." So Aaron, who was the older brother of Moses, was the high priest of the Israelites throughout their wanderings in the wilderness. And he was a beloved spiritual leader of tremendous stature, and in some ways he was even more beloved than Moses. He was, according to the commentators, more directly involved in people's lives. He was devoted to bringing peace between people who were arguing with each other. He was immensely beloved. And when he died, he was buried, and his son immediately took over where he left off. So there's some lessons for us in this part of the story. So for one thing, we should understand that the success of recovery, and even of any specific meeting or fellowship, rests on its elders. And in this case, you know, of course, in recovery, the term elder may be relative. Sometimes the more seasoned people in a group might be actually pretty young. In some cases, certainly we see that, you know, being old in years doesn't necessarily make you an elder in recovery, although often that's the case. But recovery is very much about those with more time and experience guiding those who are newer. We need to respect and value the leadership that old-timers provide. Then, when it is time for them to go, and everybody reaches that time, of course, we need to pay tribute and move on to a new generation of elders. This is what Aaron has done. He's working with Moses and God to ensure the priesthood transfers automatically to Eleazar, like there's no break in the priesthood. The duties of the priesthood have been enumerated in great detail. So if you've been listening, there's, you know, dozens and dozens of verses that talk about everything the priest has to do. It's completely explained. Eleazar doesn't have to figure anything out. He's already been told. The transition is smooth. So the group can sort of cohere around the spiritual core. And hopefully we can do the same thing in recovery. You know, prepare for transition and preserve the continuity of wise elders who can guide the group.
You've been listening to the For I Will Be With You podcast. Daily reflections on recovery from the Bible. www.foriwillbewithyou.com